Hi, Ben.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Good. I actually like to go audio only, if that's cool. I mean, I'm happy to wave hello to you.
Even easier. That's awesome. Whatever works. Whatever works.
Just kind of an insurance to conserve bandwidth. There's a little video icon near the bottom
Yep.
part of the screen. Perfect.
Boom.
All right, great.
That's even easier. I love it. Now I can just paste. So, yeah, how's it going, Kevin? How are you, man? How's your day?
Pretty good so far. It's just, you know, professor hours. I teach 3 days a week, so this is one of the off days.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. So what are you focusing on over there predominantly?
At Berkeley?
Yeah.
I teach three classes. I teach economics, statistics,
nice.
And then a basic math course.
So, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And those are all, like, really important things, and it's typically funny because kids, while they're in college, don't realize how important they are, and then they get out in the real world, and all of a sudden they're getting a crash course in economics and mathematics every day.
I like to say that, you know, you may not be interested in economics, but economics is interested in you.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And you won't be able to escape it, so just, you know, let's just dive right in, you know?
Exactly.
No, that's awesome. So, yeah, you take the lead, whatever you want to do.
All right, sure. So, if you're ready, we'll just get started. All right. We'll start with your year of graduation and your major.
Cool. I graduated in 2006. I was a music business major.
Mm-hmm. But do you recall music business has multiple tracks that the majors do? Like, there's
mm-hmm.
a management track, an entrepreneur track, some other tracks. Do you recall which one you did?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, for me, I was full-blown entrepreneurship track. I mean, I got pretty heavily involved in all areas and departments of the music business department,
mm-hmm.
But entrepreneurship was my main track.
Awesome. Also, was that the spring of 06?
Yes.
Okay.
I started in the spring of 02, wrapped up in 05. I thought I wrapped up in 05, but then actually I think on my transcripts it says 06. So I think it's just kind of that transition
gotcha.
Period there.
Sometimes music business majors would finish everything but their internship. So then it's like they've already moved away from Berkeley, but they're technically not done yet.
Yeah, exactly. I actually went the opposite way. I think I'm probably the youngest person at Berkeley to have gotten an internship. I started working for the president of A&R Columbia Records between my first and second semester. And then from there on, I was employed by Sony full time.
Well,
so
okay.
I don't like waiting. It's just like, you know, and that's kind of part of the things. It's probably going to be one of the questions that you're going to talk about. But in general, it's just about utilizing the Berkeley name as soon as possible versus just like waiting until like you get out into the real world to figure it out. You know, that's the point.
Makes sense. Oh, by the way, what was your principal instrument?
Drums.
Drums? Very cool. All right. Annoying to lug around, but very cool.
Yeah, seriously.
So, all right. We'll get to your history later, but for now, tell us about your current job. What do you do?
Cool. Currently, I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Pretty Instant Photography. We're a platform of hand-selected professional photographers across the country. So we cover all 50 states. We do work with clients like Uber, NFL, LinkedIn, Berkeley, and countless others, predominantly focusing in the B2B area and really focusing on becoming their photography company, basically being deeply ingrained in the DNA of major corporations, as well as integrating our API into marketplaces to be able to easily add a photographer with a simple checkbox add-on.
Gotcha. Now, a couple quick things. B2B is business to business. What's API?
That's absolutely correct. API, I actually don't even know what API stands for, but what API is a string of code. Well, for us, it's a couple lines of JavaScript that allow us to plug, basically communicate with other websites on the back end. And so in that capacity, similar to when you book a flight and there's a checkbox add-on asking you if you'd like to add insurance to your flight, that type of mechanism is a secondary party and a third party communicating through that platform to be able to sell their services. We have a similar technology for adding the capability to book a professional photographer. So the point here
like
being
if you have a holiday party, you book that and there's this option to get a photographer for it? Is that what you're saying?
That's correctly. So if you're looking at, you know, let's say creating an event on Splash or Meetup or Eventbrite, there'll be a pop-up that just says like, yo, check here and we'll add a photographer to this event. What that allows us to do is that person has already entered onto that main event site their title of the event, the description of the event, the location of the event, the duration of the event. So our API can pull that data into our system and automatically generate the booking. So we're working pretty closely currently with a few different real estate websites as well, trying to get deeply integrated into, like, let's say Zillow. So when you're going to go, you know, sell your house and you don't have photos for it, you can click a button and those photos will show up in your Zillow dashboard within 24 hours, things like that. That's what we're working on.
Oh, so just pretty much anything you'd need a photographer for. Here you go.
Correct.
Because I was a little curious because I think of Berkeley, and Berkeley does a lot of photos, both, you know, they often have a photographer at specific events. It's like kind of internally documenting events and stuff mm-hmm. like that. I know there's also the whole realm of marketing, and you're doing ads, and there might be photographs there. Do you specialize more in the events, or is it just literally everything?
It's grown to literally everything. We started in events because the way that we started actually was with a platform that we have called our interactive platform, which is a roaming photo booth technology, which is a proprietary software that we have that allows us to basically transfer a photo from a DSLR camera into an iOS device within seconds that are branded and tracked and all that jazz. And that's predominantly used for like major events, special events, marketing purposes. And so because of that, we were deeply entrenched in just events. And events also, top level, are the most, you know, streamlined, easiest type of shoot you can possibly do. And so that was cool. But then we, over the last 16 months or so, have expanded into all different verticals of photography, really just kind of making the user experience as you know, best as possible to be able to effectively grow the market, because we make it so simple for our clients and they can manage all their things through a central dashboard that's shared with their team and all that other jazz, that it becomes so simple that they're in fact booking photography more frequently than they would without our platform. And that's great because that kind of indicates that with doing what we're doing, we're also growing the market instead of just, you know, pulling from it as it's eventually moving to like mobile photography or like, you know, cell phone photography, you know? So that's good.
Sure. That's great. Now, you mentioned you're sort of a platform so that you're doing events, you said, nationwide. This sounds mm-hmm. a little bit like Uber, right? Where I imagine it's like you get a cut and somebody else is going out there with their camera.
True. Actually, we've been called like, you know, Uber for photography. There's so many of those kind of things these days. We don't actually look at it that way because like there really is no like personal, you know, touch points with Uber or anything like that. Uber is very transactional. Photography is still an art and requires a lot of preparation. You know, so it's a little bit more than that. But in terms of the simplicity, let's say even for the user, it's definitely along those lines. I would say process wise, you know, I think Uber is brilliant in terms of process and what they've created on the back end. And so our you know, process, I would say, is very similar to that. But the attention to detail and community and the relationships also that we develop with clients is much stronger than that of an Uber, you know?
Sure. Hey, if you're don't mind sharing, we're currently talking in early 2017. Do you mind sharing approximately what was your total revenue in 2016? Not your profit,
yeah, no,
but just the total, you know, amount of uh-huh. gigs you booked.
Yeah, top line, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't mind whatsoever. I mean, so we basically reincorporated in 2015. We started out as an LLC because it was just like a side project and it was the easiest thing to do. And then we merged to a C Corp in January of 2015. And so that's really kind of the start of the business that I like to see, because that's also when we went full time with it and instead of it just being a side project that we were balancing around stuff.
Sure.
So in January 2015, so in 2015, we did $410,000 in business. In 2016, last year, we did a little over $700,000. And over almost about 1,000 shoots. That is basically by us being pretty much bootstrapped, not having a lot of money to put towards marketing, really kind of focusing a lot on like product process, figuring out how to kind of standardize each vertical and figure all that stuff out. Now we're at a point where our platform is like ready to rock. You know, we figured out a myriad of different types of things, created processes for XYZ. And now this year, we're anticipating that we'll actually hit over 2 million, which will be great, and at least 3,000 shoots. I mean, it's going to go up quite considerably. And if we can close this deal, actually, that I've been working on for about 2 months now, we could actually see revenue this year spike up to over 7 million. So, you know, I think we're finally going to be in a good spot, you know. Takes a while, but you know, it's in just, I'd say basically in June of 2015, which was when we started the other part of our business, since from then till now is when we've done a little bit over a million in revenue. So it's like, I'm pretty happy relative to the age of the company. You know, I didn't go out and raise a boatload of money, just to kind of like figure out, you know, who are, you know, target market is, or like our actual like value prop. It's like, you know, we waited a little bit so that we could really identify what our go to market strategy is. And now we've raised on that. And so that's kind of, I think, a really important thing, because a lot of people, you know, who want to start a company are getting excited by seeing all of the stats on TechCrunch and stuff like that of all these companies that are raising boatloads of money. But then I don't know if they read the ones where it's like they've raised 17 million, 41 million, and now they're closing, you know, after a couple of years. It's like, how do you raise that much money and then have to shut down? You know, it's just like, it's intense. And so it's, we chose to go a slightly more conservative route.
Well, that sounds very similar to bands where they say, right, the ones who just have no fan base, nothing, and then sign with a major label, usually good stuff doesn't happen.
Exactly. You know, I had this conversation yesterday. You know, I mean, working in the industry for like 20 years, and then, I mean, I've always been entrepreneurial anyway. I started my first company at 11. This is my sixth company. It's like, you know, I've always been doing this, but at the same time, I view the music industry and the startup industry, or just even like entrepreneurial industry, as completely related, in terms of like bands to labels versus, you know, startups to VCs. It's just like the whole thing, the whole experience, the whole attitude is exactly the same. It's really interesting.
Very cool. For what it's worth, I actually tell people that in my economics class.
Oh, really? Awesome. Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, you should. You know, that's.
I would say that labels are basically the venture capital model, where you expect to lose money on most of them and then make a huge amount of money on the ones that succeed.
Yep, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. Yeah, yesterday I was educating my guys in the office about, you know, the old school, like, you know, 7 to 10 record deals, and then them deciding to shelve it and all this other jazz. And we were like dissecting of exactly like how basically an album for a band is almost like their kind of like a subdivision of their company, where people can purchase shares into and then kind of own and control it for long periods of time. Whereas like the band itself still kind of remains a solo entity, you know, for the most part, except for like, you know, their agreements with their manager, as an example. But like, it's just interesting. It's like, yeah. I don't know. I miss it, to be honest.
So, hey, a quick question, because this is a photography business, though. It sounds like you like starting companies. Are you a photographer?
I mean, I am a, by default, by, you know, consequence of exposure. Yes. But I wouldn't hire myself. Let's put it that way. I wouldn't put myself out there.
You're not actually one of the quote Uber drivers unquote.
Oh gosh, nope, not at all, not at all. So all of our photographers have countless years of experience. They go through three levels of vetting, federal and state background checks, like a whole myriad of different things, and we place them to shoots based on experience, equipment, location, and personality. You know, so I focus much more on the sales, marketing, process, vision side of things. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. And by the way, at the moment, like, how many photographers do you have on board, let's say, who have done at least one gig?
About 270. We keep that number actually pretty lean, because We prefer to have photographers operating more frequently than not, right? That way, like, because we have custom uploaders, we have certain processes for various things. You know, we want to make sure that, like, they're the most knowledgeable and experienced possible who are engaging with our clients versus, like, a one-off person, right?
Right, because they want
If
to
there's
feel confident that there's a lot more business coming their way if they do well.
That's exactly correct. Yeah. And so out of that, it's like, you know, we get better performance from them. We get a better there's a high level of trust there. You know, one of the things that people are always very concerned about in the industry is something that's called bleed. And bleed is like when basically, you know, if you remember back in the day, in the beginning days of Uber, you know, I'd drive like with them and then those guys would still turn around and hand me their personal cards, right? Like, you know, hey, you need a ride next time? Give me a call directly, you know? And it's like, so that's bleed, right? And for us, it's like, you know, we actually are very fortunate to not have that. And I think a big part of that is the fact that we really focus on trying to boost the frequency of photographers versus having a ton on our platform. Now, that's not to say that we don't want more. We have a waiting list currently of about 4,300, and we dial that up when we need to. Let's say we get a client like Penske or like Realtor.com, right? I mean, this kind of stuff happens all the time. These are real use cases where they're like, okay, we have, you know, eight different shoots that we need from you guys that are in like seven different states, and we need these in like 48 hours. You know, sometimes those places are not in, you know, major hubs like, you know, Boston, San Francisco, New York, DC, Chicago, Austin. It's like Waco, Texas, or somewhere in the boonies of Georgia. And you know, we have to quickly kind of respond to that and dial up, you know, the platform. And so luckily we can reach into those places to find our people and push them out. But, you know, ideally it's like the people in the city. I just did some math, because we constantly track this stuff. And, you know, if a photographer has worked one shoot with us, you know, they will make a minimum of like $162.50, right? So that would be like the minimum of like a 1 hour shoot. And we have photographers who last year cleared over 40 grand. You know, it's like, that's awesome because we're 2 years old and, you know, we are providing work for photographers, the creative force. Like for me, I feel like I haven't changed all that much. Like I've dedicated my life to helping artists build a sustainable career, doing whatever it is that their vertical and passion is. And now it's like I'm doing that and I'm getting the chance to do that for photographers. And in my mind, they're the same people. They just have a different instrument. You know, it's just like, I think that's one of the greatest things about me and my experience and the value prop here is that, you know, I come from both sides of the table. Like I come from the marketing and events and advertising worlds and just business. And so I know how to communicate with them. I know what they need. I can, you know, I understand what they're doing. I have a lot of foresight to be able to really communicate their deals and understand and interpret it. But then I also know on the other side how to deal and communicate with photographers because I've been dealing and communicating with musicians my whole life and they're literally the same people. And so it's just, I kind of, our platform is much more of almost like a, I would say, like a logistics and like a translation tool between the two sides, if that makes sense, you know?
Yeah, no,
And it's
that's
pretty
cool.
cool.
Hey, do you mind sharing if it's secret, no worries, but like what fraction, because obviously they pay you a certain amount of money and then some fraction of that goes to the photographer and some fraction of that goes to your business. Do you know about the rough percentage, like what percentage goes to the photographer versus what your business?
Yeah, 100%. Of course I do. If I didn't, I wouldn't be a good CEO. But yeah, basically, the way that it works is we have a flat rate that we pay our photographers, so they get always like the same type of hourly rate every time. And then if they do specific types of shoots, let's say product shoots or headshots, things like that, they get that same flat rate plus a percentage for each product or for each head, right? And in the end, the margin, like between the two, the split between the two ends up kind of around the 50% area.
Gotcha.
It depends on like the length of the shoot, and it depends on the type of shoot, but it kind of all ends up veering between 47 to, you know, 47.3 to 50-50 to 51-49. Like it's all kind of around there.
Gotcha.
And it depends on the service, right? But yeah, it ends up being a just a really good partnership in a way.
Hey, totally cool. And for what it's worth, I think when I look at what people are paying in tuition for Berkeley versus what I'm paid, I think I'm getting more like 10%.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So,
No,
50.
I know what you mean. Yep.
So,
I do.
You're providing a lot of service because, of course, I've spoken with freelancers. Getting work takes a lot of time and effort, and if you're doing that for them essentially effortlessly, there's real value that you're bringing to the table.
Yeah, absolutely. And the value is actually even increased because what it is, right, is you look at any marketplace out there, and let any other place where you can hire a photographer as an example, which would be Thumbtack, SmartShoot, Craigslist, all these things, right? Every single platform, A, makes the consumer, the user, have to search through portfolios, communicate with a photographer, negotiate, figure out back and forth how they're going to pay that person. Then they have to worry about if this person is sketchy, like can he come to my daughter's bat mitzvah as an example, things like that, or is he going to show up in brown shoes at a black tie gala? Like there's all these things, right? And then you have to worry about like, well, when am I going to get my photos and on what platform, how long is it going to take, and what's my recourse if I don't like them? That's like literally how it works. And then on top of that, for the photographer, they have to now negotiate and communicate back and forth with the client, which could be tedious. And then they have to go do the shoot, and then they have to go back home and edit the photos, upload them, deliver them, and then figure out a way to get money from them in terms of an invoicing system or something. So with us, the client literally just says, like, time, location, a little bit about the events. They can even select if they want somebody to be super outgoing or kind of quiet. And then they're done. It takes them under 2 minutes, and then they're literally done. And for the photographer, all they do is literally shoot, upload to our custom servers, and get paid direct deposit. We also handle the editing, invoicing, marketing, payment, you name it. So it's like we're actually...
You handle the editing, and the photographer's still getting the 50%. That's really good now.
That's correct, yeah. So it's really like we're in this because of speed, process, and scale. That's really what we're optimized for. And in order for us to do that, we have to be in charge of the entire experience from end to end. And so we hire the best photographers, because in the end, a lot of these guys work for us because it's filling their open schedules without it clogging their back office, right? Because we handle all the editing. So a lot of these guys, like, typically are charging a lot of money doing commercial work or something. They'll pick up a gig with us, like running around doing some stuff with Uber or the MBTA or whatever it is, just because it's fun and exciting and different. And they also, like, they don't have to do anything other than do what they love to do, which is the shooting part,
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome.
Very good. All right, hey, let's zoom in now.
Cool.
And let's focus on, like, your typical work day. Oh, quick, before that, about how many hours a week do you work?
Probably, like, over 100, I'd say.
Okay. You're on a lot.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I've heard that when it's a startup, that's often how it is if you're the founder.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all in. I mean, one of my other guys, like one of my co-founders over here, it was actually my first co-op from Northeastern. I hired him in 07. He's been with me since, just at various companies. He was working until 6 a.m. Monday night, just trying to get done, like, with a bunch of, like, financial stuff for tax season and all this other jazz.
Yeah, like, so, how big is your company, anyway, not counting photographers?
Yeah, exactly. So currently I have two co-founders. I have an operational and a technical co-founder, which is awesome. We've been working together. They came over from my previous company, which was called Prescott.to, which – we had a very intimate relationship with Berkeley. We actually powered the entire alumni kind of network for that, which I can get into later if interested. But it's those two co-founders. Then it's six people, like six full-time, salaried people, and we are going to be hiring about five more people in March. So it's like we're going to be expanding decently, which is good, but not too much. I made the mistake of, after we got out of Y Combinator and we raised like a little bit of money, like just to kind of like get us through a little while we figured out a couple things. I hired too quickly. which is sometimes the, you know, a typical mistake. And so I basically hired too quickly in terms of like non-revenue generating employees. And so I needed to cut back on that for the time being until we really got to a spot where we had a real solid strategy and knew exactly who we needed to hire. Now we are aligning with a new VC firm. They're going to be putting in an interim CFO, and we're going to be hiring a head of sales, a couple sales development reps, and a couple account managers. So I think we'll be growing to about 15 by the end of the year. Currently, we're at about 7.
And how many of those? Because there's got to be some of those people doing photography editing, right?
Oh, negative. We actually have just editors distributed across the United States and Europe who work also for us on a 1099 basis, but they work. This is basically for them. Most of them, it's their full-time gig. But no, those are humans that aren't in our office. The reason for that is because we don't ever want the ball to stop moving, right, on photos. So as an example, you know, let's say a shoot gets done at 9 p.m. or something like that. Traditionally, what will happen is that the photographer will bring it back, and then, you know, they might like not feel like doing it tonight. They might want to like, you know, get a drink with their friends or whatever. And then they'll wake up in the morning and they might be like a little hungover or something else. And then they're like, I don't feel like doing it now. I'll get to it later. And that's when like the whole back end gets like clogged. Right. And with us, it's just like, cool, man, if that's an event done at 9 o'clock, awesome. You have 3 hours to upload those through our custom servers. Thank you very much. Which means, let's just say for sake of simplicity, it's like midnight now by the time the photos are uploaded. Yeah. Those will get auto assigned to one of our editors more than likely at this point in Europe. So that way it's like 6, 7 a.m. for them. They grab those photos, they edit them, turn them around. We get them back by the time it's like 6, 7 a.m. our time, you know, and then we do a quick QC and then push them to the client. And that's when their credit card is charged. So it's important. The people that are in my office are people who are focusing on sales, operations, and tech, like our dev team, you know?
Sure.
So yeah, we don't have any editors in the office. Sometimes like if we need to do something or we need to do a quick, like something special, you know, we'll do it in the office. We have obviously all those capabilities, but you know, that's not what we're paid to do.
Understood. Cool. So, now, all right, let's go back 100 hours a week. That's a lot of hours. So could you describe your typical day?
Sure. A typical weekday, is, you know, I'll get up pretty much, between like 5:36. I'll, you know, start my day here listening to like startup podcasts or something like that while I'm checking emails and figuring out a couple things and really kind of getting my head in for the day. Then I'll head into the office. Some of my guys will show up around 9, you know, basically making sure proposals are good to go, getting those sent out, working on different projects that I'm trying to like hammer through and get that sorted. You know, different, just there's constantly projects and things to do, whether or not it's like, you know, analyzing our cost structures, figuring out if there's anything we can tweak there. You know, how are our marketing materials here? Do we need to create case studies for this? You know, meet with my sales team to figure out like what's working, what's not. Do we need to change strategy, change messaging, you know, figure out with the operations team, how is this being communicated to photographers? Like, can we process this, create, you know, cut and pasteable formats for this? Like, how do we just like make this better for scale so that, you know, at this current rate where we're doing like 100-odd, you know, shoots a month, how can we do this and make sure that we can do 1,000+ shoots a month and not, you know, fucking rip our heads off. So that's really like where I spend a lot of my time. Then I spend a lot of time still like talking to clients. I'm still pretty much like the main sales guy at this point until I hire those other guys. So I do a lot of that. You know, I push out proposals constantly. I'm, you know, dealing with higher end clients who are going to have like a higher frequency of stuff. Then, you know, probably like around 7 or 8 is like when I'll kind of leave the office. So like, so I'm basically in the office, let's just say, for like give and take for 12 hours, like each day in a way. Mm-hmm. Then I, you know, go out and I typically start grabbing drinks at that point. And I go to like a bar or whatever, I hang out and I meet a lot of people, who I inevitably do business with at bars. And so actually that's interesting because I hang out at nice ones, like really good bars, like Tavern Road, Pastoral, you know, Bastille, whatever. And, a lot of the people that attend those places are people who come from after work. So it's like they're either working at a pharmaceutical company or at a marketing agency. They're working for a liquor brand. Like whatever, right? And then I end up doing business with them. And so I kind of do, you know,
sort
social
of chat
business.
People up, you mean? Or are these like
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I like people. I know a lot of people. And just like ultimately, you just kind of meet people. And you know, I'm always interested in what people do, what they like to do. And I like to always be in a position to be able to add value somewhere. And so ultimately, like, business selling isn't selling. Like, selling is just kind of like helping people achieve whatever it is they're trying to achieve, right? And I just enjoy that, right? So let's say from like 7:30 or 8 to like 11, I'll be kind of, let's say, social selling. I'm just hanging out, right? And you know, talking to people and also getting my head out of the office for a minute. And then I'll get home and then I'll predominantly work until like around 1:30 or 2 a.m., kind of catching up on things and tweaking things and getting ready for the next thing, you know? But for the last like 2 months, like, we've been working to close a deal with a local venture firm, and that's been pretty much all encompassing because there's been a lot of due diligence there. There's been a lot of reporting and a lot of stuff that we needed to do. And that's all on top of actually running the business. And so that's kind of added more work on our plate for a while. And you know, the fundraising game in general is also just a nuisance and a distraction to running your business. So if you're a founder who is also out needing to raise capital, you really have to now balance two jobs on top of the many hats you're already wearing because you still have to run the business. You know, that's a thing that it's very difficult. People don't think about. They're just like, oh, I'm going to go raise some money. Not a big deal. And what you end up doing is courting countless individuals, having many similar conversations, consistently going after them like sale, sale, sale. And then all throughout that time period, if you neglect selling and growing your actual business, you will not succeed in raising capital because then they're like, so how's it going? And you're like, well, revenue's gone down because we've been so, you know, focused on fundraising. And then they're like, well, I don't know, revenue's down, blah, blah, blah. It's just like, you know, it's a very frustrating place to be as a founder. But once you get to the finish line, it's a wonderful place. So anyway.
Very cool. Hey, so one criteria you have to meet in order to qualify to do these interviews is to enjoy what it is you do. And I can definitely hear it in your voice, but could you sort of explain to the masses what is it that you enjoy about your job?
Well, I love providing work for great people, and I love solving problems and making people look like rock stars at their job. Like, you know, I'm a very purpose-driven individual, and I am just genuinely inspired by things that I do, or I do things that I am inspired by. And what gives me great joy in this job, specifically where I was worried because, you know, I'd spent 20 plus years in music, you know, long before Berklee. I didn't go to Berklee to learn to become a musician. Like, you know, I'd already toured the world and played places like Sydney Opera House and La Scala. And I'd already had a gold record for some of my work with other bands. Like, I went to Berklee because I wanted to be around the best people and like really just kind of grow as an individual. And then, you know, the industry took a really hard dive in 08 and 09. And I hung it out, like I stuck it out much longer. Like I think I ended up really making the transition with this company ultimately January of 2015. So I hung in there a lot longer than I think a lot of other people. But I was nervous when I made that transition to an extent. Like, even though I'd created this company and the whole story of starting it is another story that I can get into. But like, ultimately, I was going from being at that point in time a music tech executive, you know, working with clients like Berklee and Juilliard and USC and Universal, to running a photography company, right? And I was kind of nervous because I was like, wait a minute, like, I'm not even a photographer. That didn't really faze me, but it was more along the lines of like leaving my drumsticks over there and, you know, picking up a camera over here. It was a very weird mental thing for me, but that only lasted like a split second because what ended up happening right away was that I was putting my peers to work, which is something that I'd strived to do for so long in the music space. And at the end of the day, it's like I said earlier, photographers and musicians are super similar people. And so by giving them actual employment and seeing how, you know, this one photographer is putting like her son through summer camp because of all the work she's getting through us. One other photographer was able to quit his full-time job and do this now full-time because he's getting enough supplemental income from us. Another person was able to go on their honeymoon because of that. Like, there's a lot of things like that, which are wonderful. And on top of that, we're helping them build their portfolio. We're helping them gain more experience. We're consistently helping them do a better job and be a better photographer. And on the client side, I love having a solution for people. That's the biggest thing. And so when I've got, you know, Yoplait or General Mills or Uber or whoever else being like, yo, like, we want to do this and we really want to figure out how to do this and da, 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 da. And I'm able to be like, sure, I got you. We'll do this. Bam. And like, they're happy. Like, I don't know. Like, it's just, it makes me happy. Like, so there it is. And at the end of the day, it's like, if we're creating a new standard for how professional photography is done, and if we're really kind of modernizing the business while expanding it and growing it, then how can you not have a good time doing it? Like, it's just kind of, I don't know. Like, you have to love what you do. Otherwise you would never survive in like, especially like running or growing a company, because it takes blood, sweat, and tears. It takes a full level of commitment. It takes a lot of sacrifice for time. If you have a significant other or family or anything like that, like, they all have to buy into it because they're all going to be affected by it, you know? I mean, there's a reason I'm 34 years old and I'm like single, no kids, not married, and no dog. Like, I just like, there's a reason, you know? It's tough to find like a, let's just say like a partner.
It sounds like you already have what's called a primary relationship.
That's exactly a well put. You know, it's business has to come first at this stage, at least. And, you know, until you get to a certain part where the business is running and, you know, there's already an engine that's, you know, kind of just, now you're just kind of making sure it's oiled up and greased correctly. You know, it's difficult. So, you know, the girlfriends or wives that are with some of my employees are saints. And, you know, I choose to just kind of stay out of it altogether for now because I'll surely disappoint. Yeah. So.
Fair enough. Well, hey, so it sounds like you have interesting history with music and stuff, and you finished Berkeley, you said 05-06. I'd love to take it back to then. You've sort of gave us the very broad picture that you were in the music industry for a long time. But could you kind of put us, you know, a kind of you are here back as you were kind of in your last semester at Berkeley. And then we'll go one step at a time from there to where you are now.
So start from like basically while I was already enrolled in Berkeley, you mean?
Yeah, are you good? What's the quick preamble? Because it sounds like I'm doing a little math. You didn't enter Berkeley at age 18.
That's correct. So basically, I had studied at a music conservatory in Germany when I was younger, and then transferred into a high school in Southern California kind of midway through and got really heavy into like drum corps and that kind of stuff and started doing a lot of competition there. And then when I graduated Palm Springs High School, I took 2 years off between going to Berkeley. And I only applied to go to Berkeley. If I was going to go to college, I was going to go to Berkeley, and that's just kind of the deal. I started getting involved with Berkeley back in 97 during their like summer in LA camps and things like that. So, you know, I already had like a long history with the college, and it was a matter of like, if I'm going to go to a college, I'm going to go to this one. So, but I took 2 years off between because I was touring, with bands like Incubus, Dishwalla. I was doing a couple classical orchestras. I mean, it was just kind of, you know, I was doing it, right? I was doing what I wanted to do, and I was trying to be a full-time touring drummer. I had a partial scholarship to the school, which was awesome. And they basically were like, listen, dude, if you don't come like this semester, because I'd already deferred a bunch, you know what I mean? You're gonna have to like reapply, right? And so I was like, all right, well, I'll come and I'll go, you know, I'll do the first semester at Berkeley and then I'll take another leave of absence. But I'll at least hold my position there. And, that first semester at Berkeley, I flew back to LA 3 times to play shows. And on that third time, I just was like, you know, I was uninspired because the musicians that I was playing with back in LA effectively weren't playing while I was gone. Right. And then, meanwhile, I'd be at Berkeley surrounded by like 4,000 awesome musicians playing 24/7, you know, either in the basements of 270 or under Little Stevie's or whatever was going on in all like the practice rooms and rehearsal studios. And even if I wasn't playing, I was absorbing all this stuff. And so I had already grown tremendously as an individual and a musician just from that first semester at Berklee. So then when I flew back for that third time, it was just really, I just wasn't inspired by these guys anymore. So what I did is I basically on the flight back, back to Berklee, I just wrote handwritten letters to all the major heads of the record labels in LA and New York. And I was just like, hey guys, like, you know, I'm, you know, my name's Ben. I'm first semester at Berklee. I'm studying business. I've been doing this. I really want to like work with you. What's the deal? And, you know, I heard back from a couple people that were just like, thanks, no thanks. And then I heard back from this one lady in LA who also said the same thing, thanks, no thanks. But, you know, she appreciated the handwritten letter, so she wanted to give a call. And she was English. And so I caught her. I was able to kind of catch her for a minute and just be like, hey, like, you know, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Like, where are you actually from? And she's like, you know, London. And I was like, cool, what part? And she's like, you know, Berkshire. And I was like, really? I used to go to school there. And blah, blah, blah. Kind of broke down the communication to make it seem like, well, not make it seem, but just connect with her on a human level. Like, okay, cool. I appreciate that. That's totally rad. Like, blah, blah, blah. So we connected. We started chatting for about 5 minutes. And then at the end, I was just like, you know, I'll be in LA next week. Do you mind if I just like, pop by and say what's up? And she's like, sure, I don't see why not. So I had no intention of going to LA. So I had to borrow money from all my roommates at Berklee to catch a flight out there.
You just happened to be in LA, right? That's great.
Yeah, exactly. I already had her on the line and I was just like, yo, like I'm going to be there. Can I just stop by? And which was a complete fib, but, you know, got the money together, flew out there, showed up, you know, I had my like portfolio with me, rolled up with a suit and tie, got laughed at because the only people that wear suit and ties in the industry are the legal department or the security guards. And, you know, but I walked out with the job directly underneath the president of Columbia Records. I flew back. I was still in my first semester.
Serious paying job or like an internship or?
No. So this became an internship. It was a paid internship. Okay. And it was because I started at Berklee January of 2002. Yeah. And so that semester, then all of a sudden there's like a summer semester, right?
Yeah.
And so basically I had organized this like gig directly with the president of A&R to start that first summer. So I do one semester and then I go back and work directly for him. And so I was flying back and I had to go meet with Don Border, right? And, who I don't even think I had met at this point, really.
He's still there.
Oh, I love Don. Yeah, he and I still talk. I owe him. Well, here, this is a great moment in history. Like, basically, I, through just like my own doing, got this opportunity, right? And I now have to convince Don to let me do this. And so basically, I'm going to Don. I have to sit with him and be like, hey, Don, I haven't taken a business class here yet because I'm only first semester. You don't really know me. And I have an opportunity to work for this guy and basically be a representative of Berklee at a very high level, having not had any experience with you yet. What do you think? You know, and he could have said no, in which case I wouldn't have been allowed to do it because you need for the liability's sake, you know, the school needs to still hold liability. I pay the school for the credit. Therefore, there's a liability structure in place, whatever. He let me do it. And I thank him still every time I see him because Don just kind of trusted me for a minute and was like, all right, Ben, you got this, you know, go do it. And that turned into from then on, a full paid thing for at least 8 years. I went, you know, so I did the internship for that summer, which was a low paid internship, but at least it was a paid internship. Yeah. And I crushed it. I mean, I was the first one in there every day. I was the last one out of there every day. Like I really, really went above and beyond. And there were other interns there that weren't working for Tim. Tim Devine was my guy. They were working just doing typical like administrative shit, like going through demos and all this stuff. Like I'm answering Tim's call. I'm sitting in the meetings about the video production for these new records they're putting out with Streisand, whatever. Like I'm in it, you know? And, then it was my last day and I was about to fly back to Boston like later, you know, later that week. And he called New York's corporate headquarters at 550 Madison. And told them to hire me and give me a job. And so when I flew back to Boston, that's when I took over as the Sony Music college marketing rep, which I then did as a full-time gig through Berkeley. And then as soon as I graduated Berkeley, I became the New England retail marketing director. And then by the time I left Berkeley, I was the East Coast marketing director for Sony BMG.
Wow. Do you mind sharing about what they were paying you at that point?
While I was in Berkeley or out of Berkeley?
Both.
Okay, so while I was in Berkeley, I was making it grew because obviously I started young, and because I was a drummer and working constantly, I kept failing harmony. So I think I was in Berkeley a lot longer than I anticipated. initially the payment was only about 500. It was about $500 a week, plus like unlimited amounts of concert tickets, you know, music, like all that stuff. Back in that those days, CDs were still a currency, so. You know, I would get any time 2 months in advance before a record would come out. I'd probably get anywhere between 30 to 60 units, maybe more, you know, things like that. So I always had like a bunch of perks on top of just getting paid an extra $500 a week to be like the cool kid with all the music. Then by the time I got to like, I think sixth semester is when it got jumped up to a different salary position. I was making about 55, with benefits, 401k. And then by the time I graduated, it was closer to 100, also with 401 and all that other jazz.
Wow, so, that's a pretty good position to be in coming right out of Berkeley.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't bad. I mean, and, you know, and during this time period, like, you know, I was on the team who opened up the Red Room. I was on the Presidential Selection Committee. I was an executive chair of student government. I ran the CAF show department. I mean, I had my own management company. And I was touring with playing in bands. Like, I was just taking advantage of Berkeley as much as I could. Like, Berkeley is a wonderful institution if you take advantage of it. It's not going to do it for you, you know?
Right.
But it can definitely provide you with a good footing to grow.
Cool. So, okay, so back to you're out of Berkeley. You're the, you said, East Coast Regional Sales Manager. Is that right?
Yep, basically. Yeah, it was the East Coast Marketing Director.
Marketing Director. So how long does that thing last?
That lasted until 08, you know, which was basically D-Day for the industry. They were closing all the distribution centers all over and consolidating into their core offices. Obviously, they had offices out in Santa Monica and then their main headquarters in New York, which was at that time still at 550 Madison. That building has since been sold, you know, with further consolidation of the industry.
Sure.
It was at that time where they offered me a promotion to move to New York and work out of that thing, or take a severance package and, you know, leave happily. And I chose the latter, because at that time I was running a management company. We had a good roster of artists that I was working with and really having a good time with. We had distributed 27 records in a matter of 3 years and won a bunch of awards. And I was just kind of more inspired by the work I was doing there than marketing Martha Stewart's, like, you know, songs for Thanksgiving cooking and shit. Like, the industry was also going in a different direction than where I wanted to be. And so I decided just to take the severance and keep doing my own thing, which led one thing to another, ultimately to this company that I'm running now, which isn't even in music, but they are definitely interconnected. If you're interested in that trajectory or how real quick I could do that.
Yeah, but you could sort of go quickly on.
Yeah. All right. So basically, that management company is where I hired my first co-op intern from Northeastern. In fact, I have a photo of him when he came for the interview. We were doing a sound check in the Red Room before it had opened, because one of the bands that I was managing was, quote unquote, one of the loudest bands on campus. So Dornfeld brought them in to like do a sound check to figure out what the sound ordinance was. It's pretty funny. So that guy started working with me there. And then we developed a media company called Indie Ambassador, which was producing session videos and educational content for for artists and musicians who had recently gone independent, because that was the trend back in those days, was going from majors to indies and independents. And so we were tracking and documenting that journey for them. And ultimately through that, we discovered what their needs were, which was ultimately better tools for communication, marketing, and distribution. So that created, out of that company, the last company, PressKit. So out of that became it was a music tech company, because we were now developing the solutions that we identified from the previous media company. And that guy, Chris, his name was Chris, stayed with me there, became a co-founder of that company. And then as we were running that company is when this company kind of fell in my lap, the current company, Pretty Instant, because of an opportunity. And
yeah, what was that opportunity? Did people reach out to you? Because you said there were two co-founders.
Yeah, well, so those guys were my co-founders at the previous company that came out of this kind of trajectory, right? I just kind of like, they kept working. I found them. They were great people. We were working well together. And then all of a sudden we discovered a new opportunity to pivot, and we did it together. We're like, all right, well then we're actually seeing more success over here. Let's shelve this and let's go over there, you know? And that's how that worked. The opportunity for this was that, I was producing an event, a holiday party for a bunch of startups in Boston, as well as Techstars and Mass Challenge, and organized a photo booth for Bacardi there. That I got Bacardi to sponsor the photo booth for a few thousand dollars. And ultimately, that was paying the bar tab of the party. And I get a call from one of my buddies who was kind of setting some stuff up for the event, and freaking out because they couldn't fit the booth through the front doors of the bar. It was like a really big deal. And so I needed to come up with a very quick solution of basically how to do like a roaming photo experience so that we would still get the money from Bacardi for the bar. And my CTO at the time from my previous company, I called him over and I was like, dude, I've got this idea. This is what we need to do. And he's just like brilliant, was like, okay, well, we'll just do this and this and this and this. And we basically duct tape and bubble gum together a system that saved the day, right? That, so we basically had a client before we had a product. We basically very quickly duct taped the product together to save this opportunity. And that started the company. So it was pretty intense. And it's like, so we started working on that because it was really fun and exciting versus like the grind that we were in currently in the music side. And then we eventually brought Chris over, who was running, he was the COO of that company as well. We brought him over because we needed his organizational skills. And then ultimately we just were like, this is what we're doing.
So, is the former company still around in other hands, or did you close that one to open this?
Well, we basically partitioned it off. So we basically sold or got acquired part of the system to Universal, because like Universal Music Group, it was using it to manage all of their artists and distributed labels. So we basically created a quick enterprise spin-off and just handed, you know, gave it to them. We're like, so we sold it to them. Then we slowly shut down all of our integrations that we had with Berkeley and other colleges, because Berkeley was going back and forth in how they wanted to develop certain things. They just take way too long to make decisions on anything. So we just kind of, you know, slowed it down. We basically shut it down there, which was really sad, because what we had built, what we did with Berkeley, we're doing with Berkeley, was getting kids jobs, and it was working. It was successful. And then we just left the public version of it open for free. We just said, all right, guys, we're not going to be supporting this anymore, but have fun. It's free. Enjoy, you know?
Gotcha.
So, yeah, cool. It was cool. And get a little money out of it.
One last question is just kind of what was going through your head as you transitioned from a music industry business to a non-music business? Were you just like, hey, better opportunity over here, let's go? Were you kind of looking to do something non-music at the time? Were you kind of sad to leave music? What was kind of going through your head?
You know, it kind of happened naturally. So like, I'm very like, I follow opportunity, right? And I follow something that makes me happy or excited, right? And all the while I was in the music side of things, I was also moonlighting as like a marketing rep, right? So I would work for Bacardi, I worked for Gallo, I would launch like certain brands for them from the European continents into the States. I'd had almost 1,000 reps working for me, like in different areas. Like, And what I would do is I basically is that alcohol companies and marketing agencies as well, like experiential marketing agencies. I had a fleet of buses that ran on vegetable oil that had projector systems built inside of it to do guerrilla projections on walls and various things. Like I've done tours for the, you know, Department of Agriculture. And I mean, I've done weird shit, but the point I've done it because those places always needed entertainment, and entertainment always needed resources. And so by working in between the two, I was able to combine them. And so as an example of this was like when I was working with Magners and a couple other guys like Vitamin Water, I got them to pay me $45,000 to wrap a bus, go down to South by Southwest, produce like 5 showcases, like all this other jazz. So I have like money now where I'm paying bands to do what they need to do and distribute stuff. So I'm combining them. You know what I mean? Sure. And so I always had like 1 foot in one end and 1 foot in the other, because you got to use like alcohol companies or marketing agencies. They want access to lifestyle, and then the lifestyle needs access to the resources to do what they need to do. And so I was always kind of in the middle. And then when this happened, it was like, I was doing the same thing. I got to leave all my drums at home, and I got to just like, you know, focus on a different side of it. So it was much smoother than I anticipated. And I'd say about 60% of my employees are musicians. You know, so they get it.
Sure.
So it's interesting. So I still haven't left it in a way. But it is pretty much gone. I mean, I guess it'll always be a part of you in a weird way. The way that I stay involved in music these days is I produce the Boston Tech Jam. So I'm the founding music director for that. That's a festival that happens every year, June, at City Hall Plaza with about 8,000 people. So for that, I'm able to bring in a couple bands. That's cool. And I MC it. So that's just fun for me. And I kind of answer people's questions if they have them, but I guess that's kind of it, you know.
That's your involvement with music at the moment.
It's not much, man.
It's all good. Hey, that was going to be my next question. You just answered it. So, all right, another question I have for you, kind of moving on to the next part of the interview, is, I guess, thinking back to your Berklee education where you got that Bachelor of Music degree, and you have said you feel that what you're doing now is kind of similar to music. Is there anything in particular that you feel your Berklee education did well to prepare you for what you're doing now?
I think music education as a whole, and which was obviously driven home to me while at Berklee, really is able to give you a solid foundation on learning how to improvise. And I think improvisation is something that you just need to carry with you throughout life, because you're going to be constantly faced with situations where you need to think on your feet and improvise and roll with it. And I think that's the most important thing. I mean, outside of just general music, you know, really wiring your brain in such a way that allows you to kind of think creatively and come up with solutions very quickly and balance multiple things in your brain. That's ultimately what music training does. But I think the underlying core of everything, specifically like at Berklee, as I refined my talents there, was just the art of improvisation. I think it's just, I tell this to Berklee kids a lot when I talk to them, you know, or I come into classes, whatever, is just like, you know, don't be afraid to just kind of go after what feels right. And that might be needing to improvise real quick, but you'll always land on your feet. So I think improvising is a big one.
All right, that's great. And to turn that question around, because, of course, you went to Berklee knowing it gave that one degree of Bachelor of Music. When you look back at your Berklee experience, is there anything where you say, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this when I was at Berklee, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Anything missing or inadequate?
Yeah, a ton.
Let her rip.
As a business major there, here's the deal. Like, I was a drummer, I was a music business major, I was running a company, I was working for Sony, I was playing music. The last thing I was doing was sitting in a practice room learning scales so that I knew what a minor fucking ninth chord was or some shit. I was failing harmony every semester. I tested out of conducting. Because I can conduct, I got rhythm, fine, I got you. I passed in ear training. Awesome. I think I did okay in counterpoint, but I failed. I took harmony for 9 semesters because I couldn't do it. And so, like, I feel like there's a couple things here. One is that if you're getting a guy who's coming to Berkeley to really become a master in a certain vertical that isn't learning jazz harmony chords, they should figure out like a slightly like different harmony course for them, or even a harmony course for drummers, I think would have been much better, because you're basically asking them to learn 2 instruments at the same time as doing something else. And it just like didn't make sense to me. So I was failing at it. And that's just a side note, right? But yeah. The other side of that is that I'm learning business. I'm there to study business, grow a business. I'm on an entrepreneurial track. It would have been great to have had much more experience in understanding corporate structures, HR related things as it relates to like civics and liabilities. How about fucking spreadsheets, financial models? Making a budget. Like, I'm sorry, like I love Marty Danahy. I don't think he's there anymore. But like the accounting course and various things like that. He's got a tough gig because he's teaching musicians accounting. Like nobody like really cares. But like, I think if it's done in a method where nowadays startups and entrepreneurships and all that crap has become so like fashionable, I think there's a way where you could basically figure out how to teach these guys coming out of Berkeley how to use a spreadsheet, how to make a budget, how to make a financial model, how to forecast, how to actually build a business plan, and how to actually start and grow a company in a lean methodology, lean startup type environment. You know, figure out how to get to an MVP and then figure out how to grow your fucking company. Because I failed at my last company, because what I ended up doing is I cashed out my 401k from Sony. I got like $200,000 in from friends and family. And then I basically built out this full-on business plan, which is what they teach you in school, right? Build a business plan. It's like a book, right? And then you basically you turn to a guy and you're like, hey, build this. And it's like a waterfall methodology. And you're just going to fail because technology is moving fast. The industry is moving faster than that. You need to be agile. You need to move quick. You got to come up with something very inexpensive and effective to test the market. That's an MVP. It's a minimum viable product, and then scale it from there. It was the most expensive lesson of my life, but it got me to where I am now. And that's awesome. But the point is like, if you're teaching.
And this was your music business, the one that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I consider it a failure, you know, and the reason was is because I moved into 3 verticals too quickly. All of a sudden, I was selling to individuals who don't have money. They don't want to pay a lot of money. They'd rather, you know, fucking get a free branded website or something like that, or just use Instagram, and they don't really care. Like, that's a big problem. It's also education of musicians and the whole thing. So that was a tough market to crack, and that's like a B2C play. And, you know, it's expensive and saturated. Then we were selling to institutions. We were selling to Berkeley, Juilliard, USC, a lot of these great schools we were working with. And we were powering their alumni portal and their jobs board and all this stuff. And we were giving all their students these press kits and portfolios to easily apply to these things. And we were getting them jobs and we were getting them internships, and it was radical. But colleges just take way too long to make decisions on anything. And then, you know, they'll set like a meeting. What's the date today? Like February something, 12th or 15th, I think. So they'll be like, all right, let's set a meeting for March 15th. Okay, so that's already a month away. And in my world, like, let's set a meeting for like 10 o'clock tonight. What are you doing? You know what I mean? So they're like, yeah, it's a month away. Then somebody will like miss that meeting or like need to reschedule it. But then they can't reschedule. Oh, because finals are coming. Well, why don't we move this to May? Like, I don't know. Like, the institutional sales cycle is what'll kill any startup, right? So even though we had some really cool traction with them, and it was also part of a go-to-market strategy and an acquisition strategy with users, like, I can't tell you, dude, especially, like, with Berkeley, there's probably some stuff I can't even talk about, but in general, like, it just took 2 years of waiting half of the time just for them to make a freaking decision on anything. And like, that can kill a company, but I was still so gung-ho about making that work. So right. That's kind of, we got ourselves spread thin there. And then the other side, sorry, the third here was the enterprise accounts, right? That's the Universal Music, that's the Tommy Boys, that's the Epitaphs, like you name it. And we were working with all of them, which was also really exciting and fulfilling for me because I'm like, sweet, dude, I'm working with the majors and they're paying me. Like, this is great, you know? But they were crashing quickly. And so they were like, they wanted to like hijack our development roadmap. They wanted to pay us less. They wanted to, you know, basically use their clout in the industry to not have to pay us as much as what we were, you know, so we were kind of fighting three battles at the same time. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And, so like, and that's just not where you want to be, at a young stage of a business. And so then ultimately when Pretty Instant happens, like that event, right, happened, we got paid a grand to save a day real quick. And then I quickly called some of my buddies. And our first three clients were Red Bull, Yoplait, and General Mills. Like, it just was like a light bulb being like, dude, this is more fun over here, and people are paying us. And, like, let's do this for a minute. Do you know what I mean? And that's when that happened. So we just went to Universal. We were like, guys, we're going to focus on this. Do you want to buy this? And they were like, yeah, sure. We need it because here it is. But we're not going to give you a lot of money because we're Universal, so whatever. Okay, fine. So here, give us some money. Here's your platform. And then to the others, to Berkeley, we were like, look, guys, sorry, we're shutting this down because we're doing this. And then, and you haven't made a decision on countless things. And then for the individuals is when we were like, all right, we'll just put it up for free. So I don't really consider that like a success. You know, it was successful where it helped a lot of people. There's still 17,000 people that use it. But it's just kind of like, monetarily, it wasn't a success, you know?
I completely hear you.
So my point, to bring it back full circle, is like, you know, if we could focus curriculum at Berkeley, or at least an area or whatever, to focus much more on like how to start a startup, that would be, I think, so much more lucrative than learning outdated, you know, civil terms or whatever, figuring out what like a profit loss like chart is. Right. Because the point is, we'll look at what it is, but they won't tell us how to do it. They won't show us, you know, what this is. You know, as an example, I feel like we should all, like in the accounting class, as an example, it shouldn't be book driven and like on a whiteboard. We should be like looking into how QuickBooks works and how things like you can tie QuickBooks into like maybe your online e-commerce platform if you're going to be doing XYZ. Like, figure, like, help us actually, you know, learn that, because I learned all of that over the last 12 years, 15 years since being out of Berkeley, or however long it's been, 10 years, I don't know. But like, I literally had to learn all of that. And I still look at a spreadsheet and like go blank, you know, like,
okay. So there, I know there is a music technology course where they do teach people Excel, among other things, which may be after you were at Berkeley.
Maybe. Yeah, that might have been there. I mean, I know that we do take a music tech or whatever it is, a business tech. I remember we did something there, but it was
applications might be called. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's changed since, but like when I was there, we focused on making like HTML, like website form builder and something else. But now it's like you go to any site and there's like artificial intelligence that'll build a website for you. So like that's changed. Okay. But it's like, never once did we do anything where it was like, all right, let's take a use case of a mobile coffee shop. I mean, because and then budget it out and figure out what we need to do here. Like we never did any of that. There was never a course for that, or maybe there is now, which would be great, but we just didn't do that. And so, you know, I started an eighth grade academy apprenticeship program with Citizen Schools and Summit Partners back a couple years ago. We don't do it anymore because I moved away over to San Francisco for Y Combinator and I came back. But we would use music as a central platform for these kids. They were eighth grade, inner city kids, like just like inner city, low income kids. And we taught them, we basically, the project was to come out with a compilation record. So the kids would kind of, two of them would go into the studio. We'd make two tracks in the studio so they'd get studio experience, whatever. Then they would license all the other tracks from local artists. They'd do all the marketing and the design and all this other stuff, figure out the pricing for XYZ. And then they'd go and sell it. We'd do an event at the Federal Reserve, and then they'd like sell it in different locations. And then all that money gets invested for the 4 years while they're in high school, and then they can access it for scholarships to college. It's a great, brilliant program. It's awesome. And the point was, is that these kids, after like the second lesson, would like come at us with their eyes would open, and they would just have all these ideas of businesses they wanted to start or like objectives they wanted to do, because we just used an example that everybody in the room could get behind. And even though it wasn't like applicable immediately to what they are doing, it was something that they could at least understand, right? And so I think that would be beneficial for these days specifically, because the industry revenue streams are incredibly fragmented. Opportunities are predominantly in like publishing, songwriting, touring. So you got to figure out like, you know, how to budget, how to capitalize on whatever your IP is and figure that out. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It's been so long since I've been out of there, but my weak points are still very much the, you know, budgeting, forecasting, modeling, financial stuff. Yeah, that's a big one.
Oh, cool. Thanks. That's very helpful. All right. Hey, next question for you is, I mean, you were hustling while you were still at Berkeley and on a great career trajectory. And while, as you say, that final company didn't make you lots of money, it did slide you into this current business, which shows a lot of promise. So the point is, like, you've been on this, like, very quick, rapid path of, you know, marketing, promotion, startups, since even while you were at Berkeley. There's a lot of recent Berkeley graduates who haven't yet found that path they want to be on, as well as maybe Berkeley students who, you know, didn't find themselves with the opportunities or didn't make the opportunities you made yourself. I should say they're kind of contemplating what is, oh my god, the big scary world's coming up, what next? For either or both of those groups, do you have any advice?
I think a lot of the advice that I typically give a lot of the Berkeley kids when I come in here is to not lock yourself up into a practice room all day. I mean, if you want to be the next like Stravinsky or something, fine, I totally appreciate it, but it's to utilize the rich city that they are in. Like, so if they're still in Boston and, or they're still enrolled in Berkeley, as an example, if that's the person we're talking to right now, it's to utilize the other colleges around you to your gain. And as a result, I think, you might find that path. And what I mean by that is like, you can sit around and wait and, you know, try to apply to some random internship and then, you know, get on a path or something like that. But like, let's say you're a band in Berkeley or you're trying to market or whatever, like you should reach out to all the other college kids around you at different schools studying those specific disciplines and start to collaborate and work with them. And, you know, an example, if you're in a band, obviously you can work with your counterparts in school to record it, more than likely because they need to record something anyway for like an MPD project. So, you know, hop on that bandwagon, right? Then you need artwork, like maybe hop over to Mass Art, talk to one of those guys and just like, you know, cause they need portfolio work as well. Maybe you need some like PR work and, you know, you want to get like some better creative writing up and, you know, for your site and all that jazz, go talk to a homie at Emerson, get one of those kids, like give them a project for their portfolio. You know, maybe you need a music video or an animation, like, you know, there's all this stuff. Like we have the coolest, it's just crazy. Like with 450,000 college kids in the city of Boston from all these incredible universities, the siloing effect that is in place is too insane. You basically have everything you need at your fingertips that you could do on a barter system completely, because everybody needs work for their portfolios. And if you all work together, ultimately, like you might, you know, move the needle forward, but through and through, you actually might find something that you're maybe more passionate about. So like getting out of the Berkeley wall is, I think, a really important thing. I guess just following your gut, I think, is really important. I think it's never too late to kind of shift focus if that's your desire. There might be a lot of pressure, like, oh, I got into Berkeley, my parents, you know, are paying for this, or I've got loans that are in the six figures, and, you know, this is really what I got to do. But if that's how you feel, then maybe you should change it and maybe go do something else. And It's tough to say. Like, I guess I just like to kind of be busy, and through being busy is like how I've discovered opportunity. You know, I never like sat back and thought like, do I want to go here? Do I want to do this? What if I did this? I just kind of did, and then responded or improvised, if you will, to get to where I am now. I mean, it's been a long journey. I never thought I'd be running a photography company, you know?
Yeah. Hey, just two more questions for you. One is to kind of zoom in a little bit, because, you know, you'll be there under, I'm not sure what I'll put as your field, because it's more like entrepreneurship and service coordination entrepreneurship, and happens to be in the photography medium. But if you have any suggestions for what your field is, let her rip.
In terms of what capacity?
Oh, just I'm going to list you in a big index of careers. And I think people look you up as.
Me personally?
Yeah.
More than likely, it would be like entrepreneurship founder. It would be like businessman, I guess, in a way. You know, at this point. Just because, you know, like I identify myself as, you know, a marketing guy, an event producer, you know, a technology executive, an entrepreneur, whatever. I guess at the end of the day, I'm really just a businessman. I'm a creative problem solver. All right.
There I like go. That. That's a great one. So
Point
is, the people who listen to this interview are going to be the ones where, you know, you're something like my 67th interview or so. They're going to be the ones who see the field you're in and click on you because they're interested in it. So for people, let's say, looking to start their own companies, do you have any specific advice for them? I think I heard something you were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, don't just build up your dream company and then hope to get some revenue, but stay small, lean, and mean, and then grow, build on your success. Tell people.
Step one is to don't start a company because you think it's cool to start a company. Don't start a company because everybody else is starting a company. It seems like the cool thing to do. Because at the end of the day, you might not be best suited to actually start and run a company. Your talents might be better suited to help an established company grow and actually succeed. Not everybody needs to be a founder. If everybody was a founder, then like we wouldn't have companies, because founders rely on great people who are like industry experts or domain experts to crush. Most founders aren't like the smartest guys in the room. They hire the smartest guys in the room. Does that make sense? And so, you know, you have to, so basically that's step one, is like, if you want to go into business, make sure that there's a real reason that you're going into it. And if you've done assessment to know that, you know, by putting your energy into starting and growing a business, that is going to be the best place for that energy versus applying that energy to help something else grow and succeed. That's step one, mm-hmm. You know? Step two is to not spend a ton of money or anything like that figuring that. Step two is to really figure out that what you have is actually going to do anything. And in order to do that, you need to speak to customers. You need to talk to people. You need to get feedback on stuff. Don't waste time with NDAs and stupid legal shit. Just talk to people, get an answer of what's going on, and then make a move. And at top level, Y Combinator, Paul Graham says this, because, you know, we went through Y Combinator, which is a super prestigious like program in Silicon Valley, which is awesome. It really taught us a lot. Is to make something people want. That's number one most important thing. And, you know, that people sometimes, I think, will start something because they just think it's cool, but they're just not meant to start something. They're meant to like contribute somewhere, right?
Sure.
And maybe also what they're spending their time on isn't something that's really going to be benefiting a lot of people. It might just be like, I don't know, a cool new feature of something, you know, and there's room for that. But at the end of the day, like, you should really focus on making something that's going to contribute to people's lives. And I think that's the most important thing. And an MVP. MVP is basically like just minimum viable product. Like I said earlier, it's just figuring out what you can do like with the smallest amount of effort and time to kind of quickly validate whether or not it's worth continuing in that direction, if that makes sense.
Gotcha.
So I think that's a really big, big one that most people fail at. And in fact, I did as well on my companies. So,
all right. You know. Great. Well, hey, well, up to the last question, which is, you have the mic and you're being recorded. So is there anything we missed? Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I think overall, you know, attitude is a lot of things, and, you know, and I think at the end of the day, if you really just focus on doing something that adds value to people, that you will ultimately like be fulfilled yourself. And whether or not that ends up being in music or it ends up being in something completely different, I think the foundation of what we were able to get at Berklee set us up to be able to improvise effectively and confidently through life. And that's pretty much it. So, I mean, also, if anybody's like listening to this and wants to get in touch with me, they totally can, just because I love talking about this stuff. And, you know, I'd rather talk people through stuff if sooner rather than later if they have a need and a desire. So I'm really easily to reach. So
that's great. Should they look you up on LinkedIn or
what's the best way? Yeah, but by all means, I mean, yeah, hit me up on LinkedIn, obviously. Twitter, just at Maitland Lewis, whatever. But my direct email is just ben@prettyinstant.com. Full name, Ben Maitland Lewis, and you can just do a Google search, you'll find me, you know.
Not too many of you, I share, like, you share a pretty unique name.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Like, it works really well in terms of the SEO, right?
All right, well, hey, I really enjoyed this conversation. Fascinating path you're on. I wish you all the best success in the world this year.
Thank you. It's, yeah, me too, man. We need it. We could use a quick break, you know.
Yep. All right. Well, hey, have a great day.
Appreciate it.
Look for a message from me in the near future.
Yep. Sounds like a plan.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.